Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
It's Christmas Eve morning, if you celebrate.
It is.
This is how I'm choosing to celebrate. It feels good.
Yeah, it's, nothing better than some new Trek to celebrate.
You know, in a normal year, I would be appreciating this moment so much more because it would mean an escape from family.
Yeah, this is a long poop right here.
Sorry, I've got to go work at my important job.
The people would be pissed if I didn't tell them what I thought about this episode of Star Trek.
And now it's just any old day.
This episode wouldn't have come out on this day if it had been a normal year, though, right? They had to move the release schedule back because of the pandemic.
You know, I was thinking about the way that you said that in a different way. Like, first, yes, I agree. Like that they had to move the release map all around the calendar. But also, I thought, having moved it to this, if we were no longer in a sort of quarantine, I wonder if, you know, often shows will just take a skip on a holiday because they figure people are going to be out doing stuff. But if no one's out doing anything.
Yeah. We should probably take a skip on this week of the year. Why do we need to release 52 entire episodes of everything every year?
I don't know. I'll tell you what it is for me. I don't want to break a streak. I hate the idea of breaking a streak.
Yeah. As two noted completionist 100% types.
I mean, sometimes we complete too early, and right, that's the problem.
Yeah. Great quote from my lovely wife this morning. I sat down to tuck into this episode of Star Trek Discovery, and my wife, who does not watch this program with me, heard the beginning of the episode from the other room when everybody was toasting to Philippa.
Uh-huh.
And she just yells from the other room, "Who's Philippa?" And I yell back, "Space Hitler." And she yells back, "What a bitch."
Hey, Jet Reno, that is basically your sole use on this show, to say a line of dialogue like that.
I know.
You fucked up, Jet Reno.
Jet Reno, get on it. I mean, maybe Jet Reno has already, if it's in episodes 12 or 13, Jet Reno has already said it, so.
Jet Reno, like, everyone holds up their glasses. Jet Reno holds up hers and then brings it down, and she's like, "Philippa Georgiou, what a bitch." And then she wings it at the door to the little replicator.
Yeah.
Breaks the replicator. Taco Tuesday is canceled.
No!
And then people are saying that about Jet Reno for ruining Taco Tuesday.
Right.
What a bitch.
Yeah. But they would never say it in her presence because Jet Reno is going to shred them.
you know.
Well, it's something that this show definitely would have done. They would have drawn an equivalency between Jet Reno destroying a replicator and the crimes of Space Hitler.
Roughly the same.
Yeah.
Anyways, Jet Reno, we love her. She'll be missed, as will Space Hitler.
A lot of fine people on both sides of the mirror in these two universes.
Mm-hmm. You can't judge.
Oh, but it is our job to judge, Ben. Yeah. This episode of Star Trek Discovery that we watched the morning of Christmas Eve, like an early present.
Yeah.
This Star Trek podcast opens the presents early.
Do you want to open our present, Adam?
Let's get to it. There still may be time to return it. It's Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 11, Sukal.
Oh, look, they included a one of those gift receipts that doesn't say what the price was.
Ben, my wife and I have been fortunate lately to be the recipients of a couple of boxes of gifts. And we'll open the gift, we'll look at the return address, we will see often a gift note inside.
Yeah.
That says nothing. We've gotten three boxes from people and we don't know where they're from.
Wow.
And the box says note inside, gift, personalized gift note inside. And the last one that we opened said, like, check out the website for more great deals on this thing that you got in this box.
10% off your next order.
And this is something I've been especially cruel to you about, because I think I've done this over the last 2 weeks. I've gotten a gift without a note, and then I thought, oh, this has got to be from Ben. This is very thoughtful and nice. And every time, it's not been you. Mm-hmm. And every time I do that, I'm like, this would drive me crazy. I'm killing Ben with this right now.
I was going to save this question for after we recorded, but my wife and I were going to drop off a little something for you and your wife this afternoon.
Please leave
Is that
a note.
Okay?
I think it would really help if we saw that it was you coming up to the doorstep and dropping it off. I would honestly put a note on it also, just to lock that down.
Make sure, yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of things that I wish I had thought to get you, so that's been fun.
This is very emblematic of this quality I have, that is far happier giving a gift than receiving a gift, because especially when the gift I've received does not have any sort of identification to it, it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
I feel like the asshole because someone out there has given me something and they haven't received
it. Adam, speaking of gifts, Gray is back. What a lovely gift for Adira.
Stamets looks across the commissary and he's like, you know, all these people can be your gift if you just bother to recognize it.
Right. But Gray's back. You got Gray.
Yeah, Dearest, like, cool. Everyone on the ship can be my friend, but I actually only want one friend. Thanks.
I really love Stamets, like, the leap of faith that this is not an imaginary friend, that this is really a real thing that Adira is experiencing, turning to the blank space in the room and, like, attempting to make Star Trek first contact.
It's a great point. I mean, Stamets is a man of science.
Yeah.
A man who needs to prove the hypothesis.
Yeah.
There is no proof as he looks off into space.
It would have been really great if he'd looked off in the wrong direction, right?
That's the joke. That should be what happens exactly.
They got to do that bit.
Yeah.
Gray explains that he went away because he didn't really know how to be in this world, didn't know how to relate to a world in which Adira is able to interact with others, but Gray is not. And Adira is, like, very receptive to this, like, is basically saying, it hurt to not have you and not know why, but I understand what that's about. And I think that this this feels to me like it is a metaphor for somebody kind of working through identity and how they relate to the world and et cetera, et cetera. But honestly, it sounds like a fucking nightmare to be an ex-Trill host. Like, Gray is a prisoner inside of Adira's ankylosaur at this point.
Give that some voice, Gray. Like, don't just say that. Be more specific is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, we understand that there's a hardship involved, but like, tell us more.
Like, how hard is it? Is it Ripley in Alien Resurrection? Like, you got to find a way to end this for me?
Right.
Like, I want to know. Anyways.
Is that the end goal? Like, God, why isn't that ever stated as, this is Star Trek, Ben. Like,
yeah.
Does Gray want to turn corporeal? Is that possible? It sure seems like it might be, given that we're in the far future.
Right.
And Stamets already believes Gray to be real.
Or is this like an accidental emergence and Gray would like to go back to being a part of the mixture of life experiences and not have to live this nightmare of being like a ghost?
Also, where did Gray go?
Yeah, right.
Where would you go?
Like, what's it like for Gray? Is Gray conscious and aware all the time and stuck? Or is it nice and not terrible? Like, maybe there's a way to explain it that it's a good thing. But I just don't know. Like, we just never get into it.
That would really make Gray's case if that's what it was. If Gray's like, look, Adira, you are kind of a lot right now.
Right.
And when I go away, baby, it's awesome.
Yeah. You basically can't die and pass your ankylosaur on soon enough because what we got back here in the back is fucking incredible.
If I could make a recommendation, maybe you should stand a little closer to windows and just see what happens.
Yeah. You should ask the crew of the Discovery if they could like drop you from orbit onto the Trill homeworld. That would be great for both of us, actually.
We're testing out the space elevator for the first time. So Stamets gets a woo-woo on his communicator. It's the computer that is pinging him, saying, "We've got a life sign on the ship inside the nebula."
Yeah, you called this, Adam. You totally predicted that there was going to be somebody alive on that ship.
I think my explanation was, "This is Star Trek. They will find a way."
Life always finds a way in Star Trek.
And Saru's like, yeah, that makes sense to me because that lady we saw in the Hollow was pregnant. You know, the one with the freckles on the forehead.
She was glowing, Adam.
Her breasts had become pendulous and and full of seaweed as our as our children drink.
So finally we get the Disco jumping straight to the nebula and this is the sense of urgency that we have been missing this entire season.
It's absolutely bracing because we don't scan the nebula for, you know, like sometimes when you're a starship and there's a cloud of things in front of you, you want to like chart a course to avoid the things that are going to damage your ship.
Yeah.
No, man. We plow headlong into this thing, and it is bangers aplenty.
This nebula makes the Mutara Nebula seem like a really chill place to hang out.
This nebula makes the Mutara Nebula look like the Paulson Nebula.
Wow. Sick burn!
I think if anyone's keeping score, I think that was the nerdiest thing I've ever said on the show.
Yeah. I mean, that might be the nerdiest thing that has ever been said on a Star Trek podcast, Adam.
Yeah. Yeah.
We set the bar high here on The Greatest Discovery. I might make it nerdier, though, as I take a run at this. The
He's doing it.
They send Book's ship because it's a lot more maneuverable and it's not getting buffeted by the radiation winds. And he finds the planet that the ship in question has crash landed on. It's a planet made of dilithium. It's a dilithium as big as the Ritz by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
There was so much going on in that joke. Like, I was being led down the path of the setup, and I didn't look down at my feet, and I should have, because I actually started tripping over.
The path did not lead where you thought it was. The long walk to nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really great looking planet. It's a planet that looks like the head of that guy on Lower Decks in the ship of the broken toys, you know?
A lot of blown apart planets in this future. So Book basically like gets in and then has to let his ship autopilot his way out because he's getting irradiated so badly. Like he's got like I'm about to die, spot of blood coming out of his nose, level radiation poisoning.
Yeah, you don't like that spot.
But he makes it back. They put him in the DNA recombinator, and crucially, Adam, they put Grudge the cat in a different DNA recombinator. They didn't combine Book with his cat.
Have you ever heard of insect politics?
Dr. Pollard seems like nicer than she should be in this moment.
Yeah.
She does the space miracle of fixing Book and his radiation damage. And then they hand her a cat and is like, hey, can you do the same thing to this? She's not a vet.
Yeah.
Like, it takes special training to do what she does. Don't make those assumptions.
Her name is Dr. Tana.
I kind of like the idea, though, that she would be as good with a cat as anyone, though, because she has to treat so many different species.
Yeah.
Like, there must be, like, the way you train a doctor that works on a ship like this has got to be pretty wild.
How talented can she be if she can't fix Linus, though? Linus, perpetually broken.
Yeah. I mean, I did like that one part of this episode where Linus accidentally transports himself into the Viruba Nebula, never to be seen again.
Yeah, that was cut for time. Yeah. But I think that was a good... That was a good choice by the show.
Nevertheless, canonical. So they report this back to the Admiral, and the Admiral's like, planet of dilithium? Great! Get it! Bring it home!
I think it's interesting that Admiral, her friend your mom told your dad not to worry about, is does not have a problem with Saru going on the away team as captain. I thought for sure he was going to throw the book at him for that.
There's definitely a pregnancy in that moment, right? Like, yeah. Saru is nervous to tell the Admiral, and I guess this is the Admiral trying to be cool Admiral by not raising it as an issue.
He is sitting in that backwards turned chair during their conversation, so that checks out.
Yeah.
He's like, boy, oh boy, I'm really glad to get this good news because... the war is going far worse than is generally known, Saru. And Saru's like, I'll stop you right there. I know.
Yeah. Osiris trying to bait Disco by messing with Kaminar specifically. This is a tactic that she's used before.
Remember what Osiris did to draw Book out.
Saru is interested in jumping straight to Kaminar, like, fuck this. I would have thrown my laptop through a window if they jumped away from the Viruba Nebula at this moment. Like, yeah. What? But it seemed as too risky. Like, basically, don't fall into the trap that is being laid for you. So they stay there, and they come up with a plan to go in. They have like a kind of a map of where to go, and I guess they can therefore jump right to the spot based on Book's trip. And that's what they're going to do. So we get kind of a long series of goodbye scenes before the away team goes. And the first is Culber telling Stamets that he's going to be on the away team. And Stamets taking great umbrage with this.
I think I'm going to say it right now. RSVP Stamets, who they have murdered on this show. They've turned him into a bitchy house husband who has completely lost all of his professionalism. What the fuck?
And also just like lost his character. I feel like they wrote a different guy this season.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think so too.
I keep waiting for season one and two Stamets to appear in a scene.
I really liked not liking that guy. Like, it's okay to have that sort of character on the show.
There's things I like about this, but I wish it had felt more justified. I wish they had written him toward it instead of just kind of like stopping writing him one way and starting writing him another way.
Yeah.
I feel like Hugh Culber is now a character that I understand so much more. I mean, Culber was a character with way less screen time in the last two seasons, but now is starting to talk about like this new purpose he sees for himself as caring for lost souls, like being able to move through the universe and do good by helping others that are going through a thing like what he went through in the mycelial network. And I understand that as a trajectory in a way that Stamets just seems like I guess you're just the guy that puts his hand in the goo sometimes and is super nice to everyone the rest of the time now.
He seems like the reactive character while Culber's more proactive about his story.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
You can't go, Hugh.
Stamets in this scene gestures toward Adira in a what about our family kind of way. And this is a moment that I think would have hit a lot harder too if they wrote themselves up to this pronouncement versus declaring it in this moment, because we've been given a handful of vignettes that show how much they care for Adira and how much Adira cares for them. But I don't recall many scenes that rise to the level of what Stamets is describing here, like closer than coworker, closer than friendship, like we have to take care of Adira is something else.
Right. Like, I mean, Adira is a minor. Maybe if they'd made the case that Adira is like staying with Stamets and Culber and they like spoke up for them and said, we'll look after them while they're aboard the ship. Kind of a thing.
Poor Adira lives and sleeps in the music room of Discovery. Adira needs their own quarters.
Adira climbs inside the piano and shuts the lid. And We get another scene with Michael Burnham and Tilly, who is going to be left in command of the disco while the away team is gone. And this is going to be Tilly's first time in the big chair. And she's really nervous about this. And Michael Burnham tells her kind of a little like captain's chair secret that was true of the captain's chair on the Shenzhou and is true of the captain's chair on the disco, which is that the factory that makes this chair has some kind of construction flaw that yields chairs that have this metal burr under one of the handrails. And Michael Burnham describes it as the first time when she got into the captain's chair on the Shenzhou, she felt for the burr and found that Captain Giorgio had rubbed it totally bare. Like she'd touched this little spot on the chair to the point where it like rubbed it entirely away. And I feel like if she is capable of flicking a geranium burr like this until it's totally smooth, her masturbatory routine must have been very vigorous.
I believe you've called it before a Baroque kind of onanism.
Tilly, if you're nervous while you're captaining, you just got to remember, flick the metal bean.
I mean, cute story, right? But I can imagine what it was like to come up with this little piece of trivia and how satisfying it might have been to do so. However, what a story like this does is raises all kinds of terrible questions, beginning with, if a production facility is allowing their work to leave the factory with blemishes as large as the one that we see later.
Yeah.
Like, I used to work in a production environment that made airplanes, and like a burr around wiring is specifically a thing that you can't have.
Yeah.
Because people die where burrs are around wires. And
you would think that the tolerances on a starship would be, if you can imagine it, even higher than those on a commercial airliner.
You'd hope. You'd really hope. Yeah. A lot of questions here. Disco drops in to the pin on the map that Book's ship dropped next to the planet. And here's the timeline. They've got a 4-hour limit for radiation exposure, and the task takes 3 hours to do. The task of repairing their shields.
That doesn't leave a big window, but it leaves us enough time to get an episode of Star Trek out of this.
Their window is Star Trek sized, for sure.
They land on the planet looking quite different from the way they beamed down. Culber is wearing a sleeping bag. Michael Burnham is dressed as Little Red Riding Hood Trill Edition.
Yeah. I don't remember them going jacket shopping. And that's the initial confusion before you see that their appearances have changed.
I liked that they gave Doug Jones a little break this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that had to feel good. Acting with his real face.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the hardest role to play is yourself, Ben.
Do you think he was pissed when he like he got to this part of the script and he's like, awesome, and then he got like 15 pages later in the script and he's like, damn it, they're gonna start putting radiation burns on me, it's back in the makeup chair.
He shows up to set like out of habit 6 hours before anyone else.
Yeah.
And no one's there.
What are you doing here?
No one's there besides the gate guard.
Yeah. Sorry, we don't have anything for you. We didn't even put out breakfast.
They learn fairly quickly that they're interacting with a holo program.
Yeah. It's like a training program for some reason. It feels very haunted. It's like a snowy forest at night, and there's a like real haunted house vibes. There's Gormaganders flying around in the atmosphere.
That part made me laugh out loud. They're entering the stepwell, and Culber's like, whoa, look at that door, while literal dragons are flying overhead that no one points out.
I would have loved to see them just address it. But
yeah, I mean, no one has to say anything, but a glance, I think, would be worth it.
Just some acknowledgement. Remember that time we fought one over and over again in that time loop?
Yeah.
They meet the survivor, and the survivor is a Kelpian, and he seems to be very scared of certain parts of his nightmarish existence.
And whatever it is behind that door is not happy that they're having this conversation.
No, like the axe handle that was threaded through the door handles to keep it shut fails, and the door flies open. There's nothing on the other side of it, but the survivor runs off in terror. And Michael Burnham is like, hey, this place seems haunted and really dangerous. What do you say we split up?
This episode looks great. The effects are amazing. Feels very Guillermo del Toro-esque.
Yeah, absolutely.
In its vibe, like it's a very Pan's Labyrinthian situation.
Yeah, Doug Jones is right at home here.
Yeah. I think all of this is specifically done to make you, the viewer, ignore the fact that you figured it out right here and now. Like, right here and now, we know that this kid has been raised and reared by a holo program, and that's going to be a problem that they need to solve. But this is an episode that does not assume that you know that, and instead proceeds down the path of solving this quote-unquote mystery until finally telling you all of that 20 minutes from now. Like, it's an epiphany.
It basically has the same plot as the Future Imperfect episode of TNG.
It's almost beyond belief.
I wondered, watching it, like, if you had not seen Future Imperfect, if you were a new Star Trek viewer, if Disco was your first Trek, would you have connected all these dots at this point or not? And I can't say.
Yeah. I mean, we were little kids when we saw that episode the first time. We were idiots.
Yeah.
Not like the smart adult men we are today.
Yeah. But this is a show with swears, so little kids aren't watching it.
Yeah.
I didn't mind going on the journey with them, I will say, but I did kind of wonder why they kept circling back to, like, explaining what was going on.
Yeah.
Further into the episode, because I was like, we get it. Like, I'm happy to watch these characters wrap their minds around it, but I don't need it to be like expository dialogue that also explains it to me.
I think we may have just found the source of the burn.
Yeah, I think that's the diff.
They split up. Saru and Culber are going to go after the survivor, and Michael Burnham is going to see what gives with the monster behind the door. And her first step apparently is not to close the door and try and barricade it again.
Yeah, no.
But up in space, on the Disco, they get on sensors that there is a Federation ship approaching. They have a pretty funny reaction to this. Everybody's like, ew, Federation out here? Why? Ugh. In this neck of the woods, what are they doing here?
This is our part of space.
I mean, isn't there something going on Kaminar that they could bother themselves with? There's not even any M-class planets nearby. What are they doing?
Yeah, it's fairly quickly revealed to be Osiris' ship.
Yeah.
This is a significant moment because it's early on until he gets one right.
Right. I mean, I think this episode does a great job with showing Tilly kind of like experiencing the momentousness of this for herself, and then also experiencing like how heavy lies the crown, like,
yeah,
how much of a drag it can be to have this amount of responsibility is something that Tilly learns super duper quickly in this episode.
This moment also is not Captain on hard mode. Like, we know this from many Star Trek episodes and films that when a Federation ship approaches without comms, you treat it as a possible threat. So, like, mm-hmm. This is in the book on one of the first pages.
Yeah. I mean, if Savick knows it, you know that Tilly knows it.
Right. Tilly's no Kirk. She's keeping her pants on.
Yeah, but like, unlike Kirk, Tilly doesn't actually have the option of raising shields, because that's the main thing that they are trying to fix right now. So it's a bit of a puzzle there. In the sim, Saru and Culber come across some Federation uniforms standing in a group, and they're kind of reenacting the day that that Kaminar entered the Federation, and the admiral that is running these festivities is a Vulcan who is pretty glitched out, but is the first kind of like person that is representing the computer system running the simulation that they get to talk to.
Right.
And I like that they sort of tiptoe up to making the computer turn on them, but manage to avoid tripping that function.
I like this moment of how, when presented with new information, the holo program kind of changes course a little bit and treats their arrival as something to fix or figure out. This is a good scene for the holo program, but another bad scene for Saru, because he's incapable of using the context clues given to him by the holo people to answer his own questions. this is the double payoff of the moment earlier. What we're seeing here is 125 years of hollow program child rearing. Yeah. It's a real raised by wolves situation that this kid has gone through.
Since their appearances are being kind of projected onto them by the program, I wondered if Culber could take off his Mr. T amount of Bajoran earrings, or if that's like stuck on him, you know?
It's a good question. Does Culber now have a real hate on for pizza and their ovens?
Yeah. So I have a theory that I'm maybe going to float. Well, I'll float it now, because this scene directly abuts the one where we meet the kelp monster. And speaking of things that look great in this episode, this monster is really unique and interesting looking and really scary.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about like Saru specifically with what he looks like, because he's like, he mentions like, my heels are touching the ground. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means like his body has physically changed. It's not just that he has different loaf on. It's that like the way he's moving around is different.
Yeah.
And like he's feeling different shit, right? Like when they get to the top of the tower and he looks down, he gets a sensation of fear of heights that he is unfamiliar with.
Right.
And I'm wondering if Kelp Monster is the real survivor. Because Kelp Monster like says, see me, when it runs into Sukal later.
This is going to be one of those fucking Star Trek episodes or series of episodes where you just don't understand the monster's pathos, man. He's the real victim.
Well, I'm wondering maybe because also like some thought is given to the idea that the survivor of the crash changed a lot because of radiation exposure. And so maybe this is like what Tsukal actually looks like. And the one in the computer is a representation or something. I don't know. It's kind of an imperfect theory because Tsukal.
Hey, can I write in your margins a little bit?
Oh, sure.
Because we see that book later, the book yeah. that the old Kelpian, the old dusty Kelpian gives Saru. And it shows that image of both a Kelpian and Kelp monster side by side with the totem in the middle.
Yeah. I was too distracted. I was just wondering if Saru shaves.
Yeah.
To gather anything else that happened in this scene.
God, that has to be a nightmare, getting around those gills.
Yeah.
Like trying not to trigger a spike.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So we've got that image, and there's a symmetry to that image, Ben. I'm holding up my hands to the camera. What if they're both the same?
Wow.
The same character.
Two sides of one coin.
The holographic program is projecting these two sides of one character.
Wow. I really like your film paper / pop psychology.
Maybe the mission is to combine them.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens in the exciting conclusion next week. But in the meantime, Osira comes out of warp. She is described as not in her right mind, given the method of transportation here, because she took a transwarp tunnel, which I guess is a very dangerous way to go. And Tilly is now under a ton of pressure because Osira has declared her interest in seizing the ship and the crew. And so they have to go to Cloak and just kind of like hide from Osira's ship.
We learn a bit of trivia in this moment, and that's they can't jump while they're cloaked. I think this might have been referred to before, but
yeah,
it sort of anchors them in this situation in a useful way.
Yeah, it definitely felt like the kind of mechanic you write into a show like this, like you can't beam through a shield.
Mm-hmm.
Like smart Star Trek writing to come up with something like that.
Like whatever the inverse of the Deus Ex Machina, like you need to create the thing that is the impediment.
Right.
Artificially, instead of the solution.
Michael Burnham wakes up after getting terrorized by Kelp Monster and is in the presence of Tsukal, the survivor, and I don't think she knows his name yet, but she starts to pretend to be a part of the simulation.
Don't you think that society could do with a few more
designed to teach him how to interact with other sentient beings?
This moment, I thought, was another opportunity for Sonequa Martin-Green to flex her comedy chops, because she turns into Badgie. She's like, hey, it looks like you're trying to have an interaction with an away team. She like puts her arms into badge configuration.
Seems like you're a little bit of a shut-in. Let's help you figure that out. I know you've been trapped in here for 125 years and had a lot of computer records to learn from, but you're incredibly naive.
Hey, it looks like you're asking about how to make your eyes less sloth from Goonies-like. I brought a doctor with me. I think he can help.
All of this is to say, like, what we learn is that this guy, like, he's got the mind of a child, because, like, all he has is this kind of, like, a very elaborate computer program, but inherently limited because it's not reality. And he's kind of just been stuck in it forever. And so he has that, the people in Plato's cave disease of not believing that there's an outside world.
Do you think there's something missing from him that goes like what Spock had on the Genesis planet when he was going through Ponfar? The thing about Spock that you and I really enjoyed was how strong he was.
Yeah.
Like, he could like wing people around. There's the threat presented to us of the radiation and of the monster.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how little threat this Kelpian presents to them.
Right. We last episode we saw Saru throw a guy against the ceiling.
Yeah.
So presumably he is brutally strong.
Yeah.
The monster doesn't seem to be an attacky monster. It seems to be much more of a spooky, haunty monster.
Yeah, a get off of me monster.
Right.
Not a stop stabbing me monster. If we're ranking them, I think I'd rather be confronted with the get off of me monster.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
So as these lessons continue between the Kelpian survivor and Michael Burnham, Saru and Culber go snooping, and they find this hollow of the old man that you and I were talking about before, and they find a family decal that you'd see on a rear window of a minivan that he's drawn, and it's in this... It's in this glyph that they discover this kid's name. And this kid's name is title of episode.
Eponymous.
The trivia is that this is a term used for a child born from a tragedy, right?
Right. If you have a kid after something terrible happens to your family, like you're born Kelpian on Kaminar, You name your kid Sukal, and that's like a blessing to you know, defy the tragedies of the past and affirm a positive future.
In my family, that name was Adam.
Yeah, and it didn't work.
No, it did not.
They also realize that the cairns that they've been seeing everywhere are meant to sort of mimic the shape of the all-seeing eye that we saw on Kaminar, that the Ba'ul used to keep an eye on the Kelpians. And it's supposed to sort of like ward off evil.
Yeah, that was a neat detail.
I like that a lot. They catch up with Michael Burnham in the tower later. Like, they're told by this Kelpian old that that the fortress is where you go to find Sukal when he's scared. And that means like going across a pit on like floating platforms, like they're in a Super Mario level. They have to jump over those bullet guys.
Well, Culber's super smart because he does that thing where he gets into the water and swims beneath the platforms to avoid all of those bullets.
That way you only have to avoid some of those fish guys.
Right.
they're able to be heard on Disco briefly, but it is not, it's another, like, they get cut off before the important information makes it out.
We get a couple of scenes where people are listening in on the mission. Stamets gets a moment to do that fairly early on in the episode, and it made me wonder why they don't do that more often, because it really presents a high amount of stress for a very low price. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this is an episode. I mean, it's kind of a long episode, right? I think it's like 55 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm.
10 pounds of episode in a 5-pound bag. Like, I don't know why they have different numbers of episodes every season of Disco, but if this could have been a 15 episode season and some of this could have been gone into in more detail, I'm the kind of Star Trek fan that likes the detail. I like the world building.
Yeah, I do too.
And I like the idea of using the patchy comms as a way to build tension over a longer, slower episode.
I mean, the stress is starting to build because not only are they hearing what's happening on the planet, the away team's looking down at their hands and starting to see radiation burns form.
Yeah.
They and we can tell the time is beginning to run out.
They've been making soap and not wearing the special gloves that you use to keep lye off your hands.
Right. Right. And there was that scene that where Culber kissed Michael Burnham's hand to prove a point.
Yeah. And then they found out that Culber and Michael Burnham were the same person the entire time. And you cut back to that scene and it's just Michael Burnham holding her hand.
Yeah.
That's kind of the film paper that we were writing about Tuchel and the Kelp monster, right?
Yeah.
The first rule of the Kieth is you do not talk about the Kieth.
It occurs to me, Ben, that the away team is feeling the burn, only it's a different kind of burn, huh?
Sick burn.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of sick burns, Osira gets on the FaceTime with Tilly and just immediately launches into undercutting Tilly, going right to her insecurities and trying to put her back on her heel and not feel confident as a captain. I thought Tilly did a great job of kicking shit right back at Osira.
You tell me I'm a fraud because deep down inside, you kind of feel like a fraud.
I thought this was a great scene for Janet Kidder as Osira. I think this is the most that I've liked her this season, and it was for this moment. This is a bad guy in full control. And is taking the time to wing it around a little bit in a mean girl kind of way. It's part of why I don't necessarily trust the confidence that Tilly has in this moment, because I think she's able to repel the put downs of an Osira in this scene. And I think the bridge crew kind of like looks it around at each other and appreciates that she's putting up a fight. But this is like school playground shit. Like this has no stakes. And if Tilly thinks she's won anything here, she's in for some hurt.
She also needs to have the crew feel confident in her. And so,
yeah, she's doing it for them.
Yeah. I think it's such an interesting tactic that Osira uses, because Osira doesn't know shit about Disco as far as we know. Like, they've interacted with her once, but she knows exactly like where to stab at Tilly to potentially make the Disco less effective in combat, and it's both kill Tilly's self-esteem and also compromise the esteem that the crew may hold for her.
Tilly is really flicking the burr right now in a way that's effective in getting Osira off her back.
But down on the planet, the kelp monster comes upon Tsukal, and Tsukal has a freak out that causes like this energy pulse that comes up out of the planet, out of the nebula, and knocks the cloak off of both ships.
Tsukal does a Skyrim dragon shout. And it is a banger.
It sure is. It is another the burn, it seems like a baby burn. if you will.
And just a little guy. You know what this burn is called? It's called Grogu. Grogu.
And it's not the same as the original burn. It's a different, this is later in the storyline.
You know, people feel an affinity for this burn, thinking that it's the same thing, but it's not.
It's not. You could be forgiven for making that mistake. Like, I hope I am. My favorite ongoing Twitter troll is doing jokes about Baby Yoda being actually Baby Yoda. And every time I do a tweet about that, somebody fucking corrects me. Yeah. Actually, it's not.
It's reliably always there for you.
Yeah. Like, I get the... I'm a rat hitting a lever to get a pellet, and I get the pellet every time.
It's big fun. This has done a useful thing in that it's kind of leveled the playing field for the moment, right? Both ships are uncloaked. Both ships may or may not be damaged by this, but it's escalated the tension because with Disco out in the open, they've got to make a decision about either jumping away or rescuing the away team. And we know what Stamets would vote. He does not want to get into the spore box.
Yeah.
But he does so anyway.
And Tilly says to Osira, like, I am willing to explode this ship. Like, before I let it fall into your hands, she's holding a gun to Disco's head. But Osira has kind of solved the puzzle. She's like, there's something in that nebula that you don't want me to see. And I think that's probably where your captain is also. And Osira deploys her ship, the USS Hentai, and reaches its nasty dick-ended tentacles out and seizes Discovery.
Ugh.
Gross. People jack off to this? Ugh.
Once Osiris' ship robot claws capture Disco, it can't break free because they're made of metal and Osiris' robot claws are strong.
I don't even know why the scientists make them.
So Book has taken his ship back into the nebula. Adira has stowed away aboard by borrowing Jet Reno's comm badge, and he is able to rescue Michael Burnham, who makes it to the rendezvous point. But Saru and Culber are going to stay behind, and Adira beams themselves down with some anti-radiation medicine, which presumably is going to extend the timeline. And I wondered if there was a scene order thing that happened here, or like some kind of reshoot, because we were told at the beginning of this episode that it was a 4-hour window. But before Michael Burnham beams up, Culber says, if you don't come back within 24 hours, don't bother coming back because we're going to be dead. But then Adira beams down with the radiation meds. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, is it 4 hours or 24 hours? Like, why do they suddenly have an entire extra day? And it would make sense if, like, in the original as shot version of the script, Adira had, like, let them know they were on their way with radiation meds.
Is this just about taking more medicine? Is this about taking a new medicine that Adira has invented on the spot?
Right.
You're totally right. It's very squishy here.
I liked the detail of Adira putting the meds in their mouth before beaming down, presumably to, like, preserve the meds through the holographic transformation process.
Ooh, I didn't put that together.
Because they lost all of the away team gear that they had. But I wonder what kind of alien Adira is going to be.
Oh, that'll be a fun reveal.
Adira is an Orion.
Adira appears as gray. Like, what the what? Fuck? I am already going through some things right now with Gray. This is not helping.
The Emerald Chain seizes Discovery. They beam all of their motorcycle bad guys aboard. There's a couple of them in the spork box with Stamets, and they put like an S&M clip show device on his head, which blanks out his eyes. And Osira takes over the captain's chair, and you wonder if Osira will be able to find the bean, you know, because I feel like the disco's not going to really respond in the same way if you can't find the little bean.
I don't want to make any assumptions, but I think Osira has found the bean before.
Yeah.
I think she could find the bean again.
Orions have a bit of a reputation in that department, don't they?
They have an appetite for the bean that's legendary.
They love that bean.
Yeah.
The button on the episode is Book and Michael Burnham coming out of the nebula on his ship and seeing the USS Hentai and the disco jump away. They're too late.
It's a horrifying scene, and they didn't even get to see inside. Like, they didn't see the boarding party take control of Stamets and put the Geordi crown on him. They didn't see the boarding party beam onto the bridge and take it over and rip Tilly out of the chair. Like, they didn't see so much, and yet from the exterior, it's just as shocking a sight. Like, oof, that's a bad look.
It's terrifying.
The camera cuts over to Michael Burnham, and she's like, Tilly, what the fuck?
Maybe I should have spent less time talking about the bean and more time about talking about, like, command presence and defending the ship at all costs and stuff like that.
Here are a couple of tips about how to set the self-destruct system very quickly.
There should have been a dead man switch talk instead of a bean talk.
Yeah.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
This is hard for me to say, because I think one of the things that I've ridden for throughout our time making Greatest Gen programming was that top line thesis, the thesis of Star Trek as a place. Star Trek is a place to tell stories.
Yeah.
And when my main criticism of an episode like this is, why did they do Pan's Labyrinth in a Star Trek episode? It cuts against my thesis. It cuts against it in a way that makes me start to waver in my belief of it.
Yeah.
And in defense of Star Trek as a place, I think an episode like this is more a general lack of imagination problem than it is a specific, what if we do a movie that we like inside of a television show episode and see how that plays. Like, once again, this giant problem is one person's fault, and those odds seem pretty beatable when we've got a Michael Burnham put right next to that person, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the refrain of the problems and their solutions on this show. And this episode has a lot of good things going for it. I think it is not the performance's fault. I think the actors are acting their asses off in an episode like this. But when I hear the words coming out of their mouths at the time that they're saying them, I'm like, oh, poor Wilson Cruz. Like, he's better than this. He's better than the material. And I think the actors are better than the material in an episode like this.
Yeah.
I did not like this episode.
I kind of did like it. I mean, I think that Star Trek as a place is a thesis that has to accommodate the fact that sometimes they try to tell a story in Star Trek as a place that doesn't work that well. Every Star Trek series is riddled with examples of that.
Yeah.
This episode reminded me a lot of The Royale, in addition to Future Imperfect from TNG. And I think that there's some lumpy, bumpy stuff about it. I was very excited by this episode, and I wanted more. And I feel like some of the problems with it are that the pace feels like it's being imposed externally. Like, you have to write stories at this pace for modern television audiences is something that, you know, could be coming from the executives or, you know, somebody else. I don't know. But, like, Or maybe that's just how the writers want to write it. But I feel like the problem I've always had with Discovery is that it moves too fast. It doesn't ever let a scene breathe. It doesn't ever let a big idea take form in your head before it runs past it. I feel like they sometimes lose confidence in the ability of the audience to just ruminate on a big idea. So I kind of think that's what you're responding to partially. And I also kind of feel like this episode felt a bit scrambled, like there may have been some big changes made to it after they shot it originally or something. And I don't, you know, it's impossible to know what those changes were, given that we just know about this. But it made me wonder, and I don't know. Yeah, like I guess ultimately I have kind of mixed feelings. But there was so much amazing about this. It felt like, what if Future Imperfect had a modern television budget and special effects work, and the special effects work, the execution of this script, it is at the highest level. I think that the script itself is where all the problems are, and the acting and the staging and the set design and the, you know, the CG stuff are all incredible.
It's such an interesting version of Star Trek to think that for so many years, the liability was the effects work. And the story and the performance and stuff was all first rate. And now it feels like it's the effects work has never been better. The performance is also awesome, and it's the story that's the liability.
Yeah. So I'll be interested to see how they resolve this storyline. I wonder if this is a 3-episode arc toward the end or what.
I wonder if what you're describing is aiding me in what I'm feeling, because when you're describing like the pace of story going so fast, one of the things that I'm growing to resent is the quickness with which a solution to a problem is given almost immediately after someone realizes they need that solution.
Yeah.
Or a problem is presented itself. Like, nothing has ever been more transparent on this episode than Saru being sung a lullaby that he needs to use later on the kid. Like, and part of it is that those two scenes happened within 10 minutes.
Right.
You put it in a way that's much better than how I could, but you give a viewer an opportunity by giving them a moment to breathe and think, to experience the joy of coming up with a solution at the same time as the characters they like in a way that feels very good.
Yeah.
That you are deprived of in a story at this pace, told this way, because you've never gotten that moment to think or puzzle through. It's just bang, bang, problem, solution. And it just feels a little rote, you know?
Save that lullaby for the next episode where Adira's going to be down there. We'll get them set up with a cello and Saru can sing it with accompaniment. You know, we know that Adira knows the lullaby.
This show takes such massive swings on like that emotional epiphany ball, you know? It fucking loves smashing that thing. And in episodes like this, it kind of devalues that same currency by trading it like they do.
Well, Adam, one currency that is always valuable is the currency of priority one messages. Do you want to see if we have anything in the inbox?
Those will always spend around here.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, we have a priority one message here of a personal nature. It's from Derek. It's to Ben and Adam. The message goes like this. Being a Gen X Trekkie in today's world can feel like being trapped between dimensions.
Oh no.
Considering older Trek with 21st century eyes means sometimes phasing uncomfortably when confronting where we were as a society. I truly appreciate you both in paving the mycelial network to planet woke. I know for myself I've learned to be more accepting and endeavor to be a better person. This is true for GG, GD, and the entire Max Fun network.
Wow. Hey, thanks, Derek.
Yeah.
From a millennial Trekkie and another Gen X Trekkie, God bless you, Derek.
Hey, I think we're just all trying to do a better job. That's all it is.
Yeah. If you would like to send a Priority One message, you can do so by heading to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
That's right, and make sure you get them in, because the season finale's coming up, and then we've got a bunch of off-season programming coming. Those eps are always a thrill, and they help support the production of the show.
You're going to love it.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
I did. I think I'm going to give it to Michael Burnham this episode for sending Saru and Culber away so that she could manage the terrifying monster that they know nothing about in person without any way to defend herself or, you know, any knowledge of what the monster was. seemed like a bad idea.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I admire her bravery, but yikes.
Yeah.
She's lucky that falling upward didn't kill her.
Yeah, no kidding.
How about you? Did you have an Edward Larkin?
I'm going to give mine to Doug Jones. Finally acting with his own face, acting with his own hands. You can't tell me that there was anyone happier on that set than he to just run a comb through his hair and then be set ready.
Yeah. Do you think that in that scene where Michael Burnham tells Tilly about the metal burr, they considered having her say, like, I've seen Saru finger that thing before, and have Tilly go like, ew, he's touched it? Well, I'm not going to touch it then.
Tilly looks down at the seat cover and sees like Saru's legs, but also just a giant hog.
Saru's packing.
Yeah. Speaking of hoofs.
good Larkin, my friend. Did you happen to watch the promo for next week's episode?
I did. I dialed up the after track. Saw a little bit of a different take on the energy there from our friend Double W.
Did you watch a scene or did you watch the 30-second promo?
Oh, I did what I always do. As I booted up After Trek, I fast forwarded to the last 2 minutes and then I watched the clip that they show there. Is that not the same as what you saw?
I went to StarTrek.com and watched a 30-second, like, next time on that we used to get at the end of episodes.
Well, let's compare notes. What do you think are the chances that we saw the same thing?
I don't think we did, because it sounds like you saw a clip, and what I saw was a very, like, action movie edited sequence of scenes, lots of, like, dual wielding pistols and like hitting guys with rifles and shit, and Michael Burnham and Book declaring that they have to retake Disco.
I mean, this is a great idea. Taking their ship back is something that I was writing for a long time ago in this future universe. So that sounds like a ton of fun.
It does.
I saw basically 30 seconds of the Disco heading back towards Starfleet HQ, being chased by Osiris ship, chased in quotes, right? Acting like they're being chased with their comms down, and an admiral stepdad wondering what to do, whether or not to let them into the shield.
And you said you felt like Will Wheaton was seeming a little bit not himself.
Yeah, he went a little lower with the register. I'll give you a line read. Earlier, he's like, "Hey, nerds!" And this time, he was like, "Hey, nerds!" Like, giving it that kind of spin on it. I think he's been listening.
Wow. Amazing to think that we would have that amount of influence on what Will Wheaton would do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking down at my silicone bracelet. WWWD. I mean, honestly, it just looks like a squiggly line that goes all the way around my wrist before it hits the D part. Like the
Qualcomm logo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We gotta put that up in the merch store.
Yeah.
You think we can find somebody to manufacture a silicone bracelet for us?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure we could. Let's do it.
I love it. Well, we should leave it with our buddy Robs from here. But tune in back next week for our take on the penultimate episode of season 3 of Discovery.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're listening to us on the day we come out, hope you have a nice week between.
Enjoy it. Ta-ta.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. This podcast is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Go check out his YouTube page. He makes delicious dishes and helps you make delicious dishes. If you're looking for more Trek, discover our back catalog. We've got a lot of fun episodes. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps us be placed in the podcatchers of those who need to discover us. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram under the handles Greatest Trek. Those accounts are run by the great Bill Tilly. We appreciate you, Bill. Thanks so much. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.